Okay, we're live. What's going on, everybody? It's Billy Carson, aka Forbidden Knowledge. We have an incredible, incredible show tonight. Everyone here is going to be in the quest for ancient civilizations that's coming up in just about a month and a half. So, everyone want to go around the horn and introduce themselves?
Go ahead, Tyler.
Yeah, waiting for someone. I go by Baseforge on the internets, but my government name is Tyler.
Okay. Dan.
Hi, my name's Dan. I go by D Dunking on the internet, and right now I'm impersonating Hugh Hefner.
And quite well, I might add.
Well, thank you. What are you doing later?
And I'm with my channel's Wandering Wolf.
Yeah, nice channel. Robert?
Robert Dakota. I'm with Quest for Ancient Civilization. Mike and I are the executive producers for Austin Quest for Ancient Civilization. Mike lives in Austin, so he's kind of... and Tyler lives in Austin as well. But Mike's holding down the fort in Austin, so
beautiful.
I just wanted to give a little extra on who Mike is, not just... Go ahead, Drew.
Yeah, so I'm Drew Brophy, and I'm an artist in San Clemente, California, and I've been traveling around the world surfing and stumbled upon ancient sites by accident. And then my real key thing here is I had a near-death experience, and I'm going to be bringing a talk on consciousness that I experienced to Austin. So I'm excited to be here.
Beautiful, beautiful, man. Yeah, it's going to be an amazing conference. And Robert, it's been an honor to be able to work with you and all the great talent and the researchers and archaeologists and scientists that you bring to the event. I was with you recently in Sedona, and it was amazing. Prior to that, I think it was it North Carolina? Where were we the last time prior to Sedona? Scottsdale, Arizona. Yeah, I'm all over the world, man, nonstop. You know what it was? I worked in North Carolina that weekend. I flew to you. I did your thing, and then I flew back, I think, to finish up in North Carolina in one weekend. But I'm really looking forward to this. What I like about what we have here is a team of people that are into ancient civilizations, alternative ancient history. We all have slightly different perspective. The fundamental basis of our perspectives, I believe, is pretty much the same. In some way, obviously, there's a missing chapter in human history, and we're all trying to piece together. We're trying to connect the dots. We're trying to find out what in the world happened back then that has given us, like Graham Hancock says, amnesia. What are those missing pieces of the puzzle? How do we begin to put them together? And I really think that that can only happen when you have so many different great minds doing the research, doing the work, traveling the world, getting their hands dirty, getting in the mix, the nitty gritty, and challenging the status quo so that we can finally begin to, at least each individual, come up with their own individual hypothesis. I think collectively, all together, we are all pieces of a giant puzzle that make a great picture. And this is, not the beginning of this quest, but this quest has been going for some time. And we're now in the era where a lot of the truths are being revealed. A lot of the hidden knowledge is being revealed. And science is also helping to begin to reveal through LIDAR, through MUON scans, through SAR scan technologies. And all these different technologies are coming out now, giving us the ability to gain wisdom and knowledge like never before. I mean, hell, I have a magnetometer built into my cell phone now. I go to these sites and I start picking up the magnetometer readings and all that. And it's just incredible what we can do now with the technologies and with the energy and effort that everyone here on this great panel has. We are beginning to really create a potential new understanding of the ancient past for humanity and for the people that have been tracking and following our accounts. And so with that being said, Robert, how do you want to lead into this tonight?
Yeah, I was thinking that maybe we go into the concept of traveling and the transformation that happens with traveling, because that's a little bit how I got into all this. Besides starting out in theology, and I had to study the ancient Near East to be able to understand the context of the literature. Otherwise, you're just kidding yourself and guessing at a lot of things. So that's where I got my first interest. And then I went out traveling. I took a trip to Honduras. It was during the time of the Sandinistas, and everyone was saying, oh, look out, Nicaragua is going to invade Honduras. Don't go traveling there. You're bound to end up in a civil war. Mm-hmm. And it was my first big trip out of the country. This was 85. And I was bound to determine. I said, we're going anyways. I just won't take a lot of expensive stuff in case I have to walk back. But after that trip, I was hooked. I wanted to travel more because of the insights that I got from traveling to another country, looking through other people's eyes, looking through other people's sort of belief systems and concepts, see how they overlap or what's different. Another great thing about traveling is, you know, some of the norms that we may have in our own culture may not exist in another culture and vice versa. So it just puts you outside of the box and gives you a chance to test yourself, to challenge yourself. I mean, if you go traveling to Australia and you get caught in COVID, you might not come back, you know?
It almost happened to me.
Yeah.
That's right. Did happen to Mike. Yeah. Not exactly, but close. Isn't that right, Mike?
Man.
I traveled the entire time through COVID, and it was great. Empty planes, empty sites.
Yeah. It was beautiful, wasn't it? Best time. I almost got stuck in Australia. So I was in Australia doing a walkabout with the Aboriginal elders and learning about the Gosford glyphs, which the Evan Strong and Stephen Strong out there in the outback, those proto-Egyptian hieroglyphs. And literally, the day that we came back from the Gosford glyphs and those huge petroglyphs out in the outback, I get back to the hotel and they're already saying, you know, there's a health situation going on. And the country is talking about locking down. I said, locking down? What does that mean? I said, well, if we lock down, then, you know, you'll be trapped here. You'll be stuck here. We don't know how long. I said, are you serious? And, you know, I'm not checking the news every day. And so I found out this thing is real and I'm panicking. I'm like, I canceled my New Zealand trip and I rebooked my trip to leave Australia the next day. And as I was taking off, my friend in Australia was texting me saying they just locked down the country. So I escaped by, I don't know how many hundreds of feet in the air. I just escaped Australia. I would have been stuck for at least 3 to 4 months there because they were very strict, unfortunately. So I escaped, and then I continued to travel the world nonstop. It was great, you know.
But yeah. What was the impetus that kicked you off into traveling, Billy? Like you've around the world several times.
Yeah, I've been around the world 25 times now, and you know, when I was younger, studying aerospace technology and the encyclopedias really intrigued me about advanced technologies, you know, swept wing, delta wing, SR-71, and all the ballistics and intercontinental ballistics and everything I began to study. And then when I started making the correlation between what it takes to build this type of technology and what some of these ancient sites look like. And as I started digging into the ancient sites, when I got to the historical part of some of the encyclopedia sets, because that was my education growing up, literally encyclopedias, I was saying, there's no way that this can be done. This is me as a young kid. This can be done with just the way that they're saying. You know, it didn't make any sense to me. As I got older, I began to realize I might be right. And I said, I got to go to one of these places. So I didn't have a big budget. I didn't have a lot of money. Mexico was the closest place. And this is 30 years ago. You can go to Mexico with no passport. I didn't have to get a passport. Just show up your birth certificate at the airport, right? Hop on a plane. Boom, boom, boom. You're in Cancun from Miami in a couple hours. So I went to Cancun. I had $500 cash budget. And I never forget that day. I went to the cash exchange, the currency exchange desk, and I gave them that $500, and they gave me all this money. And I had all this money. I thought I was rich. I was kind of green back then. I laid it out on my bed, and I rolled around in it. But anyway, then the next day, my sandwich was $30 for a sandwich. And I realized, oh, God, I'm not rich. But I used that $500 to go down through the jungles of Chichen Itza back when they had dirt roads and everything. And I got, we come to that opening through the jungle, and then we come up into Chichen Itza, and then the Kukulkan pyramid is there, and the ball court, and you're like looking around like, holy crap. And then I got to climb the pyramid of Kukulkan, because back then it was wide open to climb, and get to the top to the temple and look down. And I took a picture from the top while the person that was there down at the bottom with that old 35 millimeter, you know, wine camera took a picture of me. And that was it for me, man. I was hooked. I was so hooked after that. I knew I had to spend the rest of my life going to these places and researching these places. I was so glad I had made that decision and spent that little bit of money, which for me at the time was a lot, because what I saw there was completely mesmerizing. And then when I started studying the cardinal points of the Kukulkan pyramid, the construction and how it, you know, calculated the days of the year and everything else that I was being told and taught there, it dove me down a rabbit hole of research into ancient texts and civilizations, you know, and I was just like, this is all I want to do for the rest of my life. So that, like, you're right, Robert, traveling is priceless. Number one, it expands the mind, and the mind once expanded can never go back. And it drove me into a whole nother area, whether I was going to be sharing the information and teaching it or not. I knew one thing was for sure. I would be traveling the world.
Yeah.
What about you, Mike? I know you just got back from Japan recently.
Yeah. My story is very similar to Billy's. I've been diving into all of this for years, and then seeing it in person is just, it's completely different. I think the first site that I went to was, the first site that I went to was Sacsayhuaman. So that, seeing that for my first site was just mind blowing. And I, you know, it really put things into perspective. When you're standing in front of that site, it's just, it seems impossible, you know, trying to wrap your head around how that was done. And, you know, that really inspired me. It, you know, I still remember having this thought that if, you know, if people could do this back then, however long ago, then, you know, I was at a really interesting point in my life. Well, what might I be able to do with my life? And I felt like it was very inspiring. And I just knew in that minute, in that moment, that traveling and wanting to see every single one of these sites in the world was what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. And that's what I've been trying to do. So I don't know how many hundreds of sites now I've visited or countries. I need to add that up. I know it's quite a bit. I think it's something like 300 at this point, and just visited Japan and was able to check that box, which is incredible. And, you know, there's some, you know, massive works there in Japan that don't have answers, like the often referred to spaceship stone. It's 800 tons just sitting on top of a hill over there. It's just has no real explanation as to what this is about. And these are really interesting to me, and my focus has been just documenting these things, not so much trying to find an answer as documenting them as much as possible and sharing it with people so that hopefully others are inspired to do the same thing, because like you said, it does change you.
Yeah. And those pictures, by the way, that you took in Japan, mind-blowing. Great photo. Thank you for sharing those, man.
Yeah, thank you. We got the video dropping probably next week, so
wow. Amazing.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome.
Yeah, Drew, I know your connection. One of your connections is surfing, and I surfed for 10 years when I lived out in California, like right up the road from where you live, and surf all the time. And that's kind of how we connected in Sedona.
Yeah.
Tell your story about travel. And I mean, I guess it was surfing first.
Yeah, it was very organic. And, you know, my dream was to surf all the great places in the world. And as surfers, we get to go to some of the most remote hard to get to places. And I found myself in the South Pacific, places in Tahiti and Fiji. And I was always looking for something cool to do. And, you know, I'd have locals take me to places deep in the mountains that nobody had, you know, really went to. And listening to their stories and the culture, I agree with everybody, the travel aspect and listening to the different stories from cultures and then witnessing amazing ancient stuff. For me, it was a lot of the tiki stuff, you know, things that didn't look like people in some of these islands. And then the first big pyramid I ever went to was Teotihuacan as a teenager. In a stop in Mexico City to go surfing in mainland Mexico. And it absolutely melted my brain. And from there, I just made it a quest to anywhere I was in the world is just to try to find the coolest place from ancient times and hang out with the people that had information and stories. And that's just been something that's been part of my life. And I kind of didn't really know that people were doing it until maybe 15 years ago. And like, you know, how it exploded. And like everybody was saying, once you're like standing in front of one of these sites, like how can you not stand in front of the Great Pyramid in Egypt and just go, oh, no effing way. And so, yeah, it was just a real organic thing for me. And I'm glad to be here and tell more of my story.
Nice. And
beautiful.
Yeah, what's the biggest wave you ever surfed?
I'm not really sure. There's no photo of it, unfortunately, but it was probably like a 40 to 50 foot base. Yeah. And it's one thing that in surfing, it causes you to be totally present and really, you know, dive in and get in sync with the world. It's absolutely amazing that the human body can physically track down a giant wave and somehow navigate it in perfect unison and ride this heartbeat of the planet. And it's absolutely extraordinary. And you pick up that energy when you ride it and you're literally vibrating and it's addictive. So that's another part of my story that I'll share and how it makes me feel part of everything. And just talk about the beautiful human story.
Yeah. Beautiful. Fantastic.
Tyler, tell us about Austin and your experience.
Sorry, I had to mute my mic. My dog is going to town on a bone over here. So love Austin. Love being here. I had no idea Mike was here. That was awesome. So we'll probably be hanging a little bit more, I hope. So that kind of kicked my whole journey off too, is traveling. I've been to Middle East a couple times. I've been to Mexico, God, probably 10 times. And just that area, you know, that was the first exposure I had, was when I was really young. My family took me to Mexico, Yucatan. We went and saw, you know, Chichen Itza and Tulum and all the ruins and stuff. And at the time too, I'd noticed like something's off here, but I was just not that interested in that stuff then, you know, chasing girls and doing, you know, teenager stuff. But you know, running those memories back too, I'm like, damn, I should have gone way deeper in that. And so, you know, then you have those things where you're like, I need to go back. And so, you know, years and years of that, you start. My biggest thing was, I had these ideas, and I was talking to the you know, tour guides and the local people and everything, and I'd always assumed that people would think my ideas on it were crazy, wild, outlandish things, you know, but no one skips a beat over there. When you bring up these things, especially in traditions that are very mystical, like Hinduism, and, you know, if the locals are actually still practicing the native traditions, you know, they don't, it's nothing to them. It's like, oh yeah, that's exactly what we're talking about. And so I'm shooting my ideas off and getting this. And when we go to Egypt, same thing happens. Like all of it just comes together. And the people that have the most resistance, ironically, are usually here in America. And there's, you know, there's still so much crazy wild stuff like the mound builders here and, you know, Central America and South America. There's so much stuff that it's really hard to, you know, take a lot of the arguments online seriously. And that's, I don't really engage with a lot of the arguments anymore. I feel like it's better just to show like, hey, look how weird this is. I've actually been here. You can go there and see how weird it is too. So I think it's a massive awakening when you're like, you know what, screw it. Even if I don't believe this stuff, I need to go check it out. And once people actually check it out, then it's like, okay, we gotta look into this a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Incredible. Yeah. I mean, I kind of, you know, I what I'm going to be doing at this conference, I'm going to be talking about a lot of the underground labyrinths, the underground tunneling systems, the underground, huge underground areas, how they tie to a lot of the ancient texts, the ancient star lore, the ancient mysteries, some of the mythological areas that are talked about underground, you know, Xibalbá and the Duat and so forth, and how they then relate to what we have found with what science we have today, what we do know that's there, what some of the archaeologists have discovered but has been suppressed. And I've been able to create some renderings of some of these underground tunnel systems, which I'm going to display those. And some people will probably see those for the first time. They're going to be kind of shocked as to how massive the underground tunneling systems are around these ancient sites. And that the one that was discovered by Filippo Biondi and his team using the synthetic aperture radar is just one of literally hundreds of these underground areas that exist all over the earth, that have these megalithic underground areas that just in some cases go on for miles. I was in one under the ground in Egypt where even the archaeologists, the mainstream archaeologists, call it avenues. That's how wide these underground tunnels were. And with the laser, the high-powered laser pen, couldn't see the end of one of the tunnels. And there's one that goes on for a couple hundred miles from Egypt, from Cairo, all the way to the Ziggurat of Ur. And so I'm going to be spending some time talking about that. And also talking about how these structures generate particular subsonic frequencies that create an analog, that send and receive analog data. So it's going to get really sciencey. It's going to get very geological. I'm really happy with what I'm going to be talking about because I got confirmation from two real big geologists recently as I just came back from Colorado, meeting with them, and they confirmed my work, which is really, for me, was like the pinnacle of everything, because I had been researching this stuff for like the last 4 years. I wrote about some of them 8 years ago in my first book, which was confirmed. I even on page 34 of my book, I drew a rendering of what would be underneath the pyramids at Giza with the columns going down for miles. And then obviously that was confirmed through, if anyone wants to believe it, the synthetic aperture radar. I think it's really, really sound technology, really sound data. But what I've been doing the last 3 years now is finally coming out, and I'm looking forward to presenting that at the Quest for Ancient Civilizations. And for me to get confirmation and a high five from a geologist that I really highly respect, I mean, really highly respect, he could have flew home on Saturday, a week and a half ago, and he told me he was staying to hear, to watch my work and learn about my work. And when I went back to meet him after I got done, he had washed it in the back, and he said, "I learned something from you today." And for me, that was it for me, man. That was the pinnacle for me. That was the pinnacle of my career and research in that particular field, because I'm not a geologist, but I've been studying and doing deep dives in it for quite some time now. And these last 3 years, I feel like I really unlocked some real significant data. And I think a lot of the stuff I'm going to present is going to really start coming to the forefront and potentially change the way that we look at a lot of these ancient structures. So I'm looking forward to it.
Dan, what's your big aha and your favorite travel story?
Well, traveling was, I haven't traveled a whole lot, but I live in Spokane, so I've seen the like channeled scab lands and stuff, and that's definitely impressive. You go to Dry Falls and look at it and see, you know, the way that it's, the landscape's been carved. It is interesting. You look into the science, and you know, it's you know, the debunkers will try to portray that geology as though it's definitive, and no, they know for sure what's going on. And it's like they just published a paper 2 years ago that was trying to explain why a lot of the meltwater seems to be coming from the north instead of from Montana, which they say it was coming from Glacial Lake Missoula. They say that there was like 100 little floods from Glacial Lake Missoula as opposed to Randall Carlson's one big flood. I tend to lean somewhere in between. I think Randall does at this point too, where there's like a handful of smaller floods and one big one. And that's actually backed up by local Native American legends. The Yakima have a myth of a giant beaver that was like splashing around, and it kept splashing out of the lake and causing water to flood all the way to the ocean, but it would stop at the Cascades. But one big one busted through the Cascades, carried the beaver all the way out to sea and blah, blah, blah. But So that just little bit of traveling in my own backyard actually has really opened my eyes to a lot of things, including the elongated skulls. And that's something that, you know, they just talked about, just published a few days ago, the Denisovans. About 15 years ago, they found some bones that they just realized were Denisovans by sequencing the protein. And the measurements on these bones show that these Denisovans were like 6 inches to 8 inches taller than their contemporary humans. And all of a sudden it's like all of these, the Native American skulls that were artificially modified on the, in near the Cascades, these ones, a whole shitload of them looked like these Denisovan skulls. A whole shitload of them were mistaken for Denisovan skulls and for Cro-Magnon or for Neanderthal skulls for a long time. So to me, it stands to reason they were artificially modifying the skulls to emulate another species of hominid that we found in the freaking in the Native American mounds, which is another thing worth mentioning really quick. Something people doesn't get spoken about much. The guy that debunked the Smithsonian Institute guy that debunked all of the Native American giants, all those bones were less than 6'6". He's the guy that came out and paraded other bones, which is one of my favorite jokes in the world. He's like, look, check out this bone. We don't have any giant bones. And I do that every time I get pulled over by the cops. I'm like, yeah, look, there's no drugs in my pocket. I've got keys. I've got a wallet. But no, there's no drug. I mean, fucking come on, man. What kind of bullshit, stupid crap is this? But anyway, the whole point was that guy, Ailes High Glicka, he became an anthropologist. He was a medical scientist who believed that the measurements of bones could determine like the intelligence and like the preclusivity of committing crime and all that bullshit, all that racist stuff that was like you see on the Django Unchained when he's all like rubbing on the skull, same kind of ideas, right? And so this dude literally became an anthropologist to push this shit. And then he comes out and he's like, nope, them Indians didn't have as big of bones as us white folk. And it's like they still fucking run with this almost 100 years later. They recognize everything else this dude said was fucked. But they're like, well, yeah, with this one thing, we still can't have Indians that were 6'6". And they found one, a dude in 1959. The director of the Department of Anthropology at the Carnegie Museum, Dr. Don Dragoo, found a 7'6" Native American skeleton in a mound. And when he pointed the way they debunked that now, he said it flat out. He said the in-ground measurements indicate an individual that was 7'6" tall in height, or 7'2". The way they debunked that is they say, well, that's actually an in-ground measurement. He didn't know how to do this properly. And he fucking says it point blank. The in-ground measurements indicate it's, so anyway, sorry to get on a soapbox about that. But yeah, they've been covering this one up for a long time. And now all of a sudden, it's like the cat's out of the bag. The Denisovans were all over the place. There's no denying that. They were in Australia. They were in the Americas. They were in Asia. They were in Polynesia. It's the stories, the ancient stories of giants are starting to sound more and more true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, well, David has some interesting stories about how he thinks a lot of the populations came over from Southeast Asia, Cambodia, down through Indonesia, and across the Pacific into the Americas. And he's going to have some interesting things to say about that. Dan, tell us about the other two new speakers that are going to be joining us.
We got Kurt Metzger and Duncan Trussell, the Mystery Boys. If the guys aren't aware, they're a couple of comedians out of Austin, and they do a podcast together. And these guys are hilarious as hell. I had the pleasure of being on an episode of the Mystery Boys not too long ago, and that was a whole lot of fun. Those guys are a whole lot of fun.
Those reels that you guys are they've been dropping are just crack. Every time I see one, they're cracking me up. The one where he makes his eyes all big, that's great. You guys are bullying the studio.
It's dude, it was so fun. Like, I really enjoy talking to comedians about this kind of stuff because, like, they understand that you can't let it get too dark or it's just not going to be any fun, and that we're not sitting at a round table in a back room somewhere in the FBI secret society place. We're on YouTube, trying to have a conversation that's not going to make everybody that leaves us walk outside and swallow bleach. So the idea is if you do talk about things like that island that they recently shut down, you make jokes about it. You don't just be like, oh man, that's some fucked up shit. We all know it's fucked up. Crack jokes about it. Good God. Tell us what we all don't know.
Yeah.
I love comedians that way.
Well, we have a couple more comedians that we're working on some final discussions. So once we confirm that, we'll announce them as well. But I think it was Mike or someone who brought the suggestion of bringing, and Dan, some comic relief to all this. And I think it's a great idea. And also, we're going to bring music. And that's, again, Tyler from Bass Forge is going to be bringing us music as well as speaking. And I wondered if you could speak a little bit about your music. And could you also touch on Angkor Wat? Because I remember seeing partial video that you made about sound and frequency that Angkor Wat could represent. Could you talk about those two things?
Yeah, so that's kind of like my main source of research, what I'm really into. I started out making electronic music. I'm a music producer. And so at Quest, I have a project I've been working on for about 2 years now that I'll be taking live at the end of this year for a couple of music festivals and then very widespread next year. And it's an audio visual experience, obviously, like you would get at any music show. But it's more immersive in terms of visual, and it is synchronized frequency wise with color lasers, sonically. All of it is kind of intertwined with itself, along with the visuals that I'm making myself from, temple stuff, sacred geometry. So it's kind of like watching my content without me yapping at you directly. So you just get to like enjoy it without my voice. But the Angkor stuff has been like one of the main points of my research in the past, I would say, year. I've been heavily focusing on that and a lot of the Peruvian stuff, just because there's a wealth of information coming out of both those sites. But both of them seem to be, and I watched, there's like a documentary 9 years ago about how they could possibly be connected. The ancient Mayans, ancient Peruvians, and the Cambodians, Southeast Asians, just because they have so many similar things. We've all seen the viral comparisons of their, iconography and the similarities in their cultural linguistics and stuff like that. But I was noticing stuff that really stood out to me because I work with cymatics a lot, and the patterns that you see with sound moving through sand on a plate or water, they form some very specific geometry. And it's really hard to say that someone just had this idea for the largest temple in the world, and they're just like, hey, this looks cool, let's build it. So that was my first scratching the surface moment where I was trying to figure out where the inspiration came from. There's a lot of documentation on the design principles and how Hindu temples are laid out and all of that, but there's not a lot of why. We've dissected it and we've got the template, but we don't have where that template came from. And so my initial inkling was to check if, something sonically was going on. And then I kind of got sidetracked into the Hindu pillars that look like sound waves, and it's a rabbit hole. You try and stay focused, but then you go down like 8 different paths, and so like 12 videos later I finally get to what I wanted to talk about. And so I've found a lot of cymatic patterns that match up with the layouts of these. And the most recent video I made was about the Nazca Estrellas, and these are kind of like miniature monuments, like miniature, almost like Stonehenge. They're astronomical calendar type looking things. And they're in very precise geometry, like more precise than Stonehenge or any of the other, like Nazca Playa, any of those sites. And so I was kind of dissecting that and was noticing that those patterns are matching up with Mesoamerica as well, like Teotihuacan, Pyramid of Teotihuacan. And I put them side by side, and the layout of Angkor Wat matched up, and it was even closer in detail, just because it's the nature of their temples is more fractal. They have more details. So it's a lot easier to see, hey, is this actually where it came from? Or was this just a, coincidence of these two shapes matching up? So that's been a really heavy focus of my work, is trying to see if these have some resonant based structure to them, like the back end architecture, is it resonance based? And then also testing a lot of the resonance characteristics within these places. So in Egypt, we ran a bunch of experiments with vocal tonation and stuff, and trying to figure out what frequencies chambers resonate at and all that good stuff, just so we can kind of start building a picture of what was going on. I think we all have this underlying hunch that the acoustics were involved in some way, if not a very huge part of all of these places. And what does that mean? What effect does it have on the human body, on consciousness, all that? That's because it brought me back to my music background. Whenever you go to, a concert that you really resonate with, those moments can be life-changing. Those can be the best moments that you have, as with your friends and your family and people that share that like-minded genre of music. You tend to resonate with them more, right? So yeah. Were they doing that? Were they engineering something similar to that on a population level, civilizational level? That's kind of what I'm going to be diving really deep into at Quest as well.
Beautiful, man. Oh, yeah. That's incredible. Yeah. Angkor Wat's an amazing place. I've been there several times. I've taken people on tours to Cambodia. And, when you walk down that long walkway towards Angkor and you come up on that lake and you see it, it's like, wow, it just stands out. I talked to a couple of the indigenous people there in the jungle. And, their claim was that the gods built it in a day and a night, and it was poured into place. Now, the thing that caught me was, obviously there could be some mythology in a day and a night, but the way that they say it was poured into place, and when you look at it, it looks like poured rock, right? It kind of looks like it's kind of melted and poured or whatever. But the most mesmerizing thing for me was the two things were the moat, believe it or not, and that pool up there that, well, obviously it's empty now, but where the pool would be, where the water would be in that reservoir upstairs on that first part. It's like, how in the hell did they get those stones up there? And how did they make it so tight that it could hold water? If there's water, it'd hold it. I mean, it's like crazy. It just, and you're right about those frequencies. I remember I was so fixated on that moat, because that moat mesmerized me, because I discovered that moat was taking water from the mountain in the distance, channeling the water underground, bringing it to the moat to sustain the level of the moat, and then in some way pumping the water out into the fields for irrigation at the same time. And so I did some simple mathematics with the depth of the moat, the width and the length. And I discovered that they had to move about 133 million cubic tons of mass to build that moat. But they also had to have foreknowledge of how to channel the water from the mountain and get it out into the fields for irrigation. Because can you imagine moving 133 million cubic tons of mass and making a mistake and it doesn't work? So it means you'd have to know before you dug the first part of the hole that it was going to work. Because you can't like use the resources of your entire civilization to build a moat that failed. The king would probably go off with your head anyway if the engineer didn't get it right. Right. And then I said, well, how much mass are the 2 million blocks of stones in Giza, the Great Pyramid? 90 million. So this moat is more magnificent in terms of the amount of mass moved than the Great Pyramid itself by far. That's something that hardly anyone talks about.
Well, it's just crazy. A national project, you know. That's
the easy
explanation. If you're not sure as to exactly how, you can buy my book and it'll tell you. I've discovered everything in Cambodia. It's literally every grain of sand in Cambodia. I've never been there actually, but you can imagine what it'd be like if I had. For those of you who aren't aware, I'm on Mocking Zahi Hawass. For those of you who aren't aware, I'm sure that there's some people out there wondering what the hell's that weird guy talking about. What drugs he on now? And that's none of your fucking business, but at any rate.
it seems very clear that every site I've ever been to had a relationship with water and almost like it was some type of frequency machine that was doing something to the water. Or ultimately, maybe it's for the crops, maybe it's for you, maybe it's for creating a larger connection to a bigger part of yourself, your true self. And I feel that way when I'm there in those spaces. I feel more connected, almost like you're in some ways part of it. And I don't know if anybody else feels that way, but I always feel that way when I'm in one of these sites. Mm-hmm. And a deep connection. Yeah. And that's why it's so important for people to go out and visit these sites. Because like others, you said, you come back different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Facts.
Yeah.
Facts.
There's this, I think it's Tiwanaku. It's one of the big pyramids that's, down there, in Bolivia, in the whole Puma Punka complex. But one of them is Tiwanaku. Yeah, it's dedicated basically to water, and there's a couple of things that were really interesting to me about it. One of them was that they built it on a bunch of gravel that was made to store water, so that the temple would store a bunch of groundwater. They said it was basically the hub of the irrigation complex for about the surrounding 60 miles. And in addition to that, one of the other cool things was they had hydraulic jumps, which is when high speed water hits slow speed water. It does that. So you actually gain altitude. If you come at it really fast, you got really fast moving water, you can actually make it go higher than it was. And so you can actually raise water up, which is a pretty cool trick to just have running water elevate itself without a pump or anything, especially back in the day. So that temple's it's pretty interesting stuff. And then there's also those fields up there where they've got there's big trenches that are filled with water that keeps them about 4 extra weeks of growing time up in the mountains there, which is the difference between their crops surviving or not. So they were using water as a form of technology. And my personal belief is they were also using solar power, not solar electricity, but reflected light and stuff. I think that was heavily used by the ancients. I think a lot of times when you see these pictures of somebody holding something that they're getting from the sun, a lot of times it's something that we would recognize as a concave mirror, perhaps something very not too complicated, but that seemed, technology you don't understand is magic, right?
Mm-hmm. No, I think you're on point with that, Dan. I agree with you on that. I've seen some of those things as well, and I think you're right on point with that. A lot of stuff that they understood ways of utilizing the elements in nature as a form of technology. And I believe they also had a way of combining it with spirituality. And this is why some of these sites are so spiritual. And so you can feel the energy, when you go there. One of the things I'm going to talk about too, I know that Wizard of the North made a donation. Thanks for the donation. I'm not sure which account it went to, but I put it up here. And Wizard of the North says, someone please explain to me how the Kailasa temple was built and where did the 200 to 400,000 tons of waste rock go, right? Where did it go? That's a great question. I wish we all had the 100% answer to that, but I can tell you this. I'll be talking about the vibration and the frequency of the basalt. I will be talking about the analog data that it transmits and how, which was approved by a geologist. And also, just understanding this part, which I'll talk about now on this live, is that if you're off by 5 centimeters, and I have a rendering of the actual site rebuilt and reconstructed off starting with the first cut, off by 5 centimeters, the structure doesn't work. The alignments don't work. The structure is malformed and warped. Some of the areas eventually would collapse just by standard basic weathering. And so... It wouldn't have stood the test of time. And of course, you know, we're talking about cutting directly into a solid mountain. And where did the excavation go? Where is it? It's gone. It's nowhere to be found. So it's really intriguing how they did this. I can't wait. I'll be there in 2028 to research it and take some close up shots and try to see if I can find any evidence of tool marks and things like that. But the amount of precision required is so incredible that you couldn't be off by even a few centimeters on your first cut, or you couldn't create the entire temple complex from that mountain in the perfected way that it's set now. It tells you that they had some form of understanding of stone cutting and guidance. You know, you have to guide that tool in a way that we can't really understand today.
Yeah, the Kailasa Temple, I could be wrong here, but I thought that I had heard somewhere that there are texts about the removal of the stone there, and them using some kind of machine that took all the grinded up stone and turned it into air, and it just disappeared.
Wow.
I'll actually be there in December. I'm doing a tuk-tuk race across the entire country of India and hitting all the ancient sites along the way. So this is going to be quite a journey. Right. But that site has been the number one place that I've wanted to get to that I haven't been to. And I think two or three times I've had to cancel trips to India. So fingers crossed, this is the one that works out. It seems like everything's lining up really good for this one.
Yeah, beautiful, man. Yeah. Well, I can't wait to see what you bring back.
Drew, you've been surfing in Bali, right?
Many times, yes.
Uluwatu or...
Yeah, mainly around Bali, Lombok, Zimbabwe, Sumatra, and islands around there. You know, and there's so much in art. You know, so I'm a professional artist, and I see in the art like all the similarities in styles, symbolism, and things like that. That was another big interest of mine. I really wanted to ask, has anybody heard discussions about some of the sites possibly being machines that create a low pressure gradient that harnesses like the electromagnetic field between the atmosphere and the lithosphere that would then create like a pump? You know, the water would come kind of like a hurricane, you know, the pressure gradient creates a water upwelling. If you could create a stationary low pressure system that would ultimately collect the atmosphere and then pump water out of the ground. I had been parts of discussions with other people about that. And if anybody else heard any types of things like this.
Yeah, that's the first time I've ever heard that. It sounds plausible.
I have a section on that in one of my books, actually. So there's been a couple tests for not the Cambodian temples particularly, but for large structures like the Great Pyramid, they can induce lenticular clouds. They do have a measurable effect on the environment, especially when water's involved, because the soil conductivity and the resistance from water can act together like a circuit if they're properly separated and used in the right ways. And so when you look at the big main temples like Angkor or the Pyramid of Djoser, there's what looks almost like a well or like a pump shaft that goes down in there. And I don't know if we haven't just gone deep enough to see if it's actually there's more underneath it. But both of them, if you compare them side by side, they look strangely familiar. Like there's a shared mechanism for what that does, and whether that's a pump or not, I don't know, but I do know that Matthias, do you know Matthias DiStefano?
Yeah.
So Matthias talks a lot about how they were cleaning the water in Southeast Asia, like they were preparing the water to handle a higher level consciousness or receive, you know. And when you think about it, it kind of makes sense, because if you don't have clean water, That was kind of the leading cause of death for humans for a really long time until we figured out wells and stuff. So So I can see it plausibly being something that had to do with water or making crop yields better. I know Randall just talked about how crops near pyramids and sacred sites usually have a higher yield and grow faster, potentially being a multi-harvest in one season type of a device. But either way, all of that stuff, I think there's enough hard science now to say that there's something going on with those things, that and the fact that they're all associated with water, we need to start looking into that.
Yeah, facts. Yeah, even Teotihuacan is built on top of an aquifer. Giza, you know, obviously, and the aquifer's dry now. I've been down there in those dry tubes. It seems to be, a pretty consistent theme. At Dendera, when you're walking up to the Temple of Hathor in Dendera, as you're walking towards a big open gate to go in, there's a place where they used to bring their vases to gather water coming out of this. It's self-pumped, maybe utilizing the same system you're talking about. So obviously there's running water there. And to the right of Dendera, there's a place called the Pharaoh's Well that I've taken people. It's hardly ever open, but I got private access in 2023. And I took 80 people down there. And you go from 110 degrees, bright sun, no clouds, down about five stories into ice cold water. I mean, ice cold water and complete utter darkness. And you splash the water on yourself and it kind of tricks the brain and it releases some DMT from the pineal gland. You kind of get this out of body experience or the psychedelic experience naturally. The ancient Egyptians say this is where the pharaohs would go to talk to the gods. Now I understood why. But there's water beneath the Sahara Desert in the middle of nowhere at 110 degrees above the surface, not a cloud in the sky. And you have all this ice cold water just five stories deep. So water is all over the place out there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Oh, I had a super chat ask about the if we could prove that the pyramids were made after the Younger Dryas. And I would say that we can't exactly prove that they were made after the Younger Dryas. We can prove that there was a lot of work done on them after the Younger Dryas. For sure, the Fourth Dynasty saw a whole lot of work done on the other pyramids that. And then there were some other people asking about like plans for which hotels and stuff to stay at. I'm probably going to stay at an Airbnb when I come down, to be honest. But there's this place in Austin, Texas that the two guys that live there will know exactly what I'm talking about. It's called Sixth Street. And it's really easy to just find it and get trashed for. Well, I think that I'm going to go out into my limb and say that Shane Gillis couldn't make it all the way down, stopping at every bar. So, hell, I couldn't even find the bar we were looking at.
Dan, you can sleep on this couch. I'm not going to have you go down to Sixth Street. You can have the couch, but
no, that's fine. We're talking about that. The event happens, and then you got to get tore up afterwards. You don't have to go down to Sixth Street to get tore up. I mean,
Dude, there's better spots. We'll show you.
Yeah. It depends on how tore up you want to get.
We'll get you trashed too, but we'll make sure that you're not going to get robbed and pass out on the street.
Oh, hell, I didn't get robbed. I was just down in Austin for a week. Down promoting this whole event. Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun. That's where I was talking to Kurt and Duncan and stuff. And yeah, it was great. I went down there like all the time, over and over and over every night. I went down and got drunk. I mean, there's one night that I did take off. Well, I slept in, but that was because it was the. Yeah. Well, you know, I'm not 25 anymore. You know, when I was a younger guy, beer goggles was like, oh, she's cute when she ain't. But now that I'm old, beer goggles are like, yeah, I can handle that substance. Yeah, bring me another beer. Let's keep going till 3 a.m. Then I'm like, fuck, man, I'm not 28 anymore. Oh my god.
you vibes. Well,
On the Bali and the water technology, if you were up at the palace up at Ubud, Drew.
Yeah, it's all water.
There's a spring up there that they put in a pool. They built a temple around it. People go there to pray. There's one place where the water comes out in several different sections before it goes down and feeds all the rice that feeds all the people. All the people go there and make blessings and offerings with flowers, and they cleanse themselves with a super clean water, with the real pure water. And then all that water with the prayers and the intentions goes down into the food. Isn't that a technology too?
Yeah. Yeah. Structured water.
Yeah. Directly transferring, you know, their intentions, their prayers into the memory of the water.
Mm-hmm. I just find it interesting that people all over the world seem to have been doing something similar with similar technology. I've seen it everywhere. And, you know, a lot of these sites, you know, like Teotihuacan, I think there was water like everywhere in those big avenues. Mm-hmm. But also like Chichen Itza, and that's built on a big cenote. There's a cenote underneath. And imagine most of those sites have water underneath them. Mm-hmm. I'd be interested to see the science come forward on that. And
you know, at the very core of Land of Chems hypothesis, Jeffrey Drum, the very core of it, there's some of it that I look at, I'm like, I don't know about, but the very core of it is based around these edifices draw lightning. Lightning infuses the ground with nitrogen, and this increases the crops. And you know, like I say, there's other parts of the hypothesis I look at, I don't know so much about, but that makes total, I mean, that really makes a lot of sense. That makes a point. All of a sudden, if you figure that one out, it makes a point as to why you'd stand a bunch of stones in the middle of a damn field. And it starts making sense as to why a bunch of these things, like Stonehenge, for example, are in the middle of a damn farmer's field. You know, it was an important place to the village, but it wasn't in the city center. It wasn't in their market. It wasn't in their capital. It was off where the sheep ate. But that makes sense. So it's kind of interesting. And then when you were talking about different water technologies, about different pressure to create basically a cyclone type of thing, where I was wondering about the same kind of thing, whereas I wonder if you would to put one of those in the water and constantly draw light, you wonder what kind of things we would find happening then. Because you know, a lot of these things, like we can hypothesize about what we're going to see, but when you get things on different scales, a lot of times there's just really basic laws that they end up just being like, well, you know, you get above a certain, I mean, the most common when everybody understands when they talk about science is the whole quantum stuff, but it happens in a whole lot of other areas too, where you just get to a certain area, a certain size, and it's like, well, that doesn't work anymore, the science has changed now. And so anyway, you know, there's a lot like that that we're just now getting to the point of actually figuring out. It's kind of sad how much they push against as far as these things go, and then how it'll be funny to watch. Like I was just talking about the Giants of Maine, it'll be really funny to watch in the next 10 years how they play this out, because they've used the term giants. I mean, giants works because you know, it's a very biblical term, right? But ultimately, it's kind of like using the term conspiracy theory to crap all over this. It's like there were skeletons found in the Americas between 6'6" and 8 foot tall. None of these are outside the realm of human possibility. Not a single freaking one. So the whole these were giants. That's almost like putting a tinfoil hat on it just by its label. But they love doing that. It's a very common thing. Filippo Biondi is a great example. They've been conflating his idea of a second Sphinx with flat earther, literally all the way to take it to the flat earth. It's like, how many, we know Egypt made sphinxes, man. Come on. How is that the same as a flat earth? How the hell is that the same as denying evidence? It's like that, but they put them in the same box, and then you can make fun of one. Yeah. By extension, it's like really simple stuff, and it breaks my heart to see the quote-unquote scientific community engaging in such shenanigans.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. Ridiculous. Everyone watching live right now, we're going to be at the Quest for Ancient Civilizations, and that's going to be in Austin, Texas. You know, if you can make it out, that would be amazing. We got researchers from all over the world. We have Dan Richards, Hugh Newman, J.J. Ainsworth, Drew Brophy, Duncan Trussell, Kurt Metzger, Tyler Engel, David Hatcher Childress, Randall Carlson. Of course, I'll be there as well. Billy Carson, Dan Richards, Hugh Newman. Well, I told you, we're back to the beginning, but you guys
can go. I'm not being there twice.
Yeah, right. I know, right? You can go to questforancients.com. I've been dropping a link in the live chat. We'd love to see you out there. And meet and greet, and of course, come see some of these great lectures and research and workshops. And signed books and everything else we can do. It's going to be a great opportunity. Great. We always have a great time at these events. It's very upbeat. It's very happy. People come from all over the world. And the beautiful thing is they finally come to a place where they can meet other people that are on the same frequency and vibration that they are. They can speak on these topics and not feel weird or strange. Nobody's going to say they're crazy. You can have open conversations. A lot of people come to these events and they make lifelong friends and they become friends for life. I've met people that have gone to some of these conferences and met their future husband or wife even. I've taken people on tours that didn't know each other and ended up getting into relationships and getting married. So you can get to these some of these gatherings where we are all talking about the topics that we're really passionate about. It just makes it so much worthwhile because when you go back to your home, a lot of the times you look to your left and your right, and there's nobody to talk to about these amazing topics because they don't want to hear it. And that's why these gatherings are really so important. You kind of get with people on the same vibration and the same frequency. So we'd love to see you come out to Austin. I'm looking forward to seeing all y'all out there.
Likewise.
Yeah, it's going to be great. I've made a lot of good friends at these kinds of things, and I asked Mike to marry me, but he said no. So, you know, do what you can in this world. Do what you can.
Don't give up. He plays hard to get.
I just bought some roof and all. I got it. He's mine. At least for 48 hours. And we got to demonetize at the end. Bam.
That's Dan after he's gone down 6th Street.
Going down on 60. You think that shit's free?
Why don't you and Tyler close us out, Mike, with give us an idea of what's there to do in Austin, what's the hot places to see or something.
Yeah, you know what?
I'll tell people about the ECO.
I'll leave that to you because I think you're probably plugged in a little better than me.
I will say Austin has the best food in the country. I don't care what anybody else says. There's so many good restaurants here. Just the guides give you good. They're all accurate. Places to go out if you want to see Dan on the streets, 6th Street. There's an east and a west. East is kind of dirty, and then west is kind of more, you know, nice-ish. There's a domain to go out. Lots of really interesting little Austin is like seven cities in one city. And a lot of people see just downtown, but there's also Lake Travis. There's also the downtown lake, Lady Bird Lake. You can get paddle boards and go down there. There's literally just endless stuff to do here. So if you are coming out, then your itinerary, you can fill it with literally anything that you're into.
And the event space is just, ACL is just top notch. You'll be able to walk outside and just go get whatever and do whatever you want. Everything that you could want is within just a few blocks of there, including the paddleboarding. So, whatever you want to do, it's just a prime location right in the heart of the city.
Yeah, I walked from the event center to the river to smoke some of the legal Delta 9 THC. That's not legal now. What kind of fucking THC you gotta smoke there now? God damn. Texas.
We're moving backwards down here on that.
All right. Yeah. That's all right. I'm sure that they'll find something somewhere in that town. I mean, I don't know. Nobody offers me anything when you look like me, but they usually think you're a cop. But every now and again I find something.
Maybe.
Just hit a couple buttons up, you know. Just put a couple buttons up. Maybe you get some
fun. Yeah. See, I'm thinking about going to the bar after we get off here, and I'm not sure if I wear this shirt, I could either get laid, mugged, or you know, the shit beat out of me for no apparent reason.
That's the fun of it.
We'll see. I'll probably just put on a different shirt, look like a normal homeless guy. It's easier just getting carded when you walk in because they think you're probably on something. They're like, I got to get you out of here. Another problem we have in this town was everybody's on. There's like so much fentanyl that the way they keep the people out that are bums is they just card them. And they're like, it's such a funny, weird, backwards thing. They're all, the 7-Eleven can't legally discriminate, but the bar is just like, you got ID? And he's like, what planet am I on? So he has to go to 7-Eleven. It's a weird little dynamic. The bars are, but I get carded a lot because of that dynamic. I walk out there a little drunk. They're like, shit, that boy off the street.
Well, luckily, they're coming to the quest for ancient civilizations. I don't think a lot of people are going to be hitting the bars.
But you never know. Austin's got some good ancient energy.
Yeah, a lot of people.
I'll be doing a lot of podcasts while I'm there. As soon as I get done with the conference, I'll be doing a podcast run through. You know, there's a lot of podcasters in Austin, Texas for some reason. Yeah. So many.
A ton of them.
We've got bars on every level at the ACL, and the VIP will be where all the speakers are on the mezzanine. And I just talked with the ACL today about getting the permits so that we can get some food trucks there, Mike.
Nice.
So we'll have food trucks just outside. And we're going to have a great time.
If you haven't had barbecue in Austin, Texas, period, you absolutely need to. It's an experience that's not like you get in the rest of the country. Right? I mean, by the pound, and you got white bread on the loaf of white bread, just like you get at the grocery store. Everywhere else I go,
they always say, you got to try our barbecue, and I do. And I'm like, this is not it.
It's
spoiled here in Texas, though.
I could get it. You know, it's funny. The more I travel the country, I see it. It's a lot of it's based on like immigration and stuff. Like over on the East Coast, you have the Italian and the Jewish places, and here on the West Coast, it's the Asian and Mexican places, and then down in Texas, it's that Tex-Mex and barbecue all the way, right?
And breakfast tacos.
Yep.
I'm really looking forward to meeting all the people wherever they come, and just hopefully inspire them to travel like all of us and be inspired, ask questions. Yeah. And for all those out there who are listening, I'm going to be mainly speaking on my recent near-death experience, which is a hard thing to talk about. That's why Robert brought me on. Mm. Probably not for the surfing or any of my other experiences, but I'm really looking forward to sharing that with the people and how it relates to ancient sites and everything that's happening, this great remembering that I believe that we're having, and it's coming. There's no stopping it. So the more you learn about it, the better off you'll be. Yeah.
Beautiful, brother. Thank you, man.
Yeah.
Well, thank everyone for coming. I've dropped the link in the live chat quite a few times this evening. It's also in the caption of this video. You can click that link. I'll make an audio of this. I'll put the audio out. And it's on every one of our platforms. You can go check it out. Questforancients.com. Love to see you there. We're going to have a great time. As you can see, we're going to have a ton of laughs. We laugh nonstop. It's nothing but jokes. But it's a great way to spend your time laughing and learning. Sometimes, you know, these conferences and lectures, they can be kind of boring, you know, but when you can laugh and have a good time and learn at the same time, it's a plus. It's a win-win for everybody. So looking forward to seeing everybody out there.
Absolutely, guys. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
All right, y'all.
It's going to be a blast.
Y'all. Yeah. Thanks. Y'all later. Peace.